laity in the church. The first thing I think I need to say is the obvious. What is the laity's biggest role in the church? That's parenting. This is the most sublime and important vocation of the human person, it seems to me, to form these young people in faith and in personal integrity and so forth. And that's always the future of the church. That's the future of our civilization. So that needs to be said. But when we talk about laity in the church, we're usually talking about something else. I divide it into two big categories. One I call the soft influence of the laity in the church. What do I mean by that? I mean the influence of the laity who were not involved in any kind of official church hierarchy or church government, church business, you might say. Who would be some examples? Well, St. Benedict, he was a lay person all the way through. The monks were lay people when he started, then they became clericalized. But Dante, so by their writings, by their example, by the movements they started, Dante, the Divine Comedy, isn't that a huge influence in the church and in Christianity in general? The spiritual exercises. They were written by a layman. Ignatius was a layman when he wrote that book. He had to do some finishing touches afterwards, after he was ordained, but basically it was written as a layman. I think of Dorothy Day in our present context, or novelists like Flannery O'Connor. So all kinds of what I call soft influences that are extremely important, and they enter the mainstream gently, without great fanfare, but in the long run, they can have an immense impact. Today, one of the most important soft influences, it's something that's taken place in the last 50 years, is the transformation of the theological enterprise in the Catholic Church. At Vatican II, by the time the council ended, there were almost 500 theologians officially accredited to the council by either Pope John the 23rd or Pope Paul the 6th. Every single one of them was a cleric. Today, if you go to the meeting of the Theological Society of America, I'd say 90% of the personnel is either laymen or laywomen. That's a huge transformation, a huge role of the laity in the church, which they did not have before. But let's talk about how the laity influenced church policy and church government directly. I'm going to talk a lot about principally about the role of secular authority. So I'm not advocating a recap, a renaissance of the marriage of throne and altar, but the lay voice in church government until, let's say, 1870, the First Vatican Council, 150 years ago this year, was considerable. It had four periods. So the one I'm going to talk about is from the beginning, reading until 1870, then 1870 to Vatican II, Vatican II to Pope Francis, and then Pope Francis. So the first period, this long period, three forms of intervention. One was direct activity, influence in church councils, local councils, and ecumenical councils. Crisis intervention and the nomination of bishops. Let's jump all the way ahead to the year 325. the great Arian controversy in the church, which was not only throwing the tearing the church apart, especially in the East, but also the empire. And Emperor Constantine decided to convoke a council, the first council in the world, in the history of the church, in the history of the world, in which supposedly all the bishops of the world were invited to attend. And they met in Nicaea, outside Constantinople. They met in the imperial palace, and the emperor himself presided at some sessions. In effect, he gave the council its agenda, solve this problem with Arius, and so the heretic who believed that Christ was not fully divine. He gave the bishops full authority, but it was his meeting. The Bishop of Rome did not even attend. He sent two priests to represent him. When the council was over, he said that he would implement its decrees. So he did not make the decisions, but he said he would implement them afterwards. So that was a pattern all the way through in the 8th century. Second Nicaea, who convoked it? The Empress Irene. I'll leave you with that thought. Let's move ahead now to, say, the 15th and 16th centuries. Well, no, let's do a big medieval intervention. In the 11th century, the bishopric of Rome was in a terrible mess. It had fallen into the hands of lay magnates who were competing with one another and making sure that their own sons or brothers or nephews were elected pope. It was a mess. This ended in a big schism in Rome in the middle of the 11th century. Emperor Henry III came down from Germany and called a synod of Sutri, in which he saw to it that all three of these contenders were deposed, and then he proposed his own candidate, a relative, and this was the beginning of a reformed papacy. So it was an extremely important intervention, solving a massive church problem. And same thing could be said about the great Western Schism in the 14th century, but moving now right ahead to the 16th century, let's talk about the Council of Trent. So the Lutheran problem, how's this going to be handled? Well, from the very beginning, the cry was a council. A council is the way the church deals with its major problems. The only problem was the Pope, Clement VII, did not want to call one because he was afraid it would try to depose him. He was not altogether wrong. So he delayed the council from 1523 until he died in 1534. But the Emperor Charles V kept up the pressure to convoke the council. Had he not exerted that pressure, it's doubtful that the new Pope, Paul III, would have convoked the Council of Trent. So extremely important intervention, crisis intervention, you might say. So what's the council going to do? According to the Pope, it was to deal with the doctrinal questions only and leave reform of the church to himself. The problem was, one of the big things crying for reform was the papacy itself. Charles insisted that the council also deal with church reform. And finally, the council agreed to deal with both issues to great effect. For one thing, the fact that today we take for granted that bishops reside in their diocese is due to the Council of Trent. So, extremely important intervention. Moreover, at the council, each of the rulers of Europe, Catholic rulers, sent envoys to the council who were ambassadors and who pressed at the council the interests of their own sovereigns. And this was basically to the good of the church. The best indication of their importance is that when the council ended, all the official participants had to sign their agreement with the council's decrees. So the first to sign were the cardinals, about six of them, then the archbishops, then the envoys of the rulers, and only then the bishops, which gives you some idea of their importance in the council. Moreover, what about theologians at the council? Crucially important body. The Pope appointed two. Queen Margaret of Hungary, the regent for the Low Countries, sent eight. And this was a typical pattern for the other rulers in Europe. So you see that the secular authorities, so the laity, had a crucial vote, a crucial role in the Council of Trent, and was typical of other councils. For instance, back in the Middle Ages, when with the intervention of Emperor Henry III, as his reign moved on and there were other popes, his cousin, Pope St. Leo IX, began to travel all over Europe, calling reform synods, reform councils. And the Council of Mainz, Pope Leo and Emperor Henry III jointly presided. So what also had happened by the time of the 16th century, and it really goes back much, much, much farther, it was absolutely clear by the 16th century that the lay authorities had the authority to nominate bishops. These nominations had to be approved, of course, by the Holy See, but by and large, the Holy See accepted these nominations, and of course, there was, as always, some skullduggery, but in general, the lay people, they were on the scene, and they had sometimes a better feel of what was needed than a distant papacy. So the papacy really could directly nominate and name bishops only in the papal states, so this relatively small state within Europe and a few other places. But by and large, the appointment of bishops was in the hands of these lay authorities. And that goes all the way up till 1870. What happens in 1870? Pope Pius IX convokes the First Vatican Council. So as the cardinals were preparing the council, the question arose, what about inviting the secular authorities? Well, they certainly wanted to do it. But the political situation was so fluid, they did not know how to proceed. So they issued a very kind of wishy-washy invitation saying you can send somebody if you want to send somebody, and nobody took it up. So Vatican I, the first council in history without laity, without direct lay participation. That was an accident, but it's kind of set a pattern. Moreover, in 1870, the Italian forces united all the small states of Italy into the nation of Italy. So Italy became a monarchy, and all the concordats that the Holy See had with the smaller states in Italy, such as the Kingdom of Naples, the Republic of Venice, and so forth, all those concordats were dead letters. And in each one of those concordats, the state had the power to nominate bishops. So all at once, Pope Pius IX found himself with the authority to nominate all the bishops in Italy. A similar event occurred in France in the early 20th century, and all at once Pope Pius X found himself able to nominate all the bishops of France. And so it went up until 1975, when King Juan Carlos of Spain formally renounced the privilege of the Spanish crown to nominate bishops. So that all at once, by the middle of the 20th century, the nomination of bishops became an exclusively clerical affair, which is what we have today. Not a bad process that we have today, but it has that horrible limitation. So another effect of Vatican I was the papal infallibility and papal primacy defied at the council. This had the indirect impact of putting a damper on local councils or synods. So you must remember that from the very beginning, at least from the second century, local councils, so councils and synods, there's until 1965, those are synonyms. So these local councils, these local synods, were always active. They were active up until Vatican I. Remember, in the USA, the diocesan, provincial, and plenary councils of Baltimore, right? In the 19th century. After Vatican I, those were finished. It just didn't happen again. So then we get to Vatican II. So what happens between Vatican I and Vatican II? Basically, the end of local councils, local synods, the Holy See having full authority for the nomination of bishops, and the exclusion, the thought that laity does not have an active role in an ecumenical council. So then when John the 23rd convoked Vatican II in 1962, there were no lay people present. Never even occurred to them to invite lay people. But as the council moved on, they said, well, where is the laity? So as you know, there were a handful of laymen and laywomen finally at the council. They had no right to speak. The only influence they had was indirect. It was considerable, but indirect. They could do it in private conversations. So that's where we were, and that's where we are until Pope Francis. Pope Francis, complicated man, comes from the global south, has concerns not quite the same as the North Atlantic. He's a Jesuit, has a training quite different from the secular clergy. Also, he is a child of the Second Vatican Council. He did his theology while the council was in session, part of it after the council, and accepted the council as fact, as the way things are, and that's the way he's been governing his pontificate. Among the council's many important decrees and statements is this definition of the church as the people of God. And that stuck with Francis. And if you read what he's written and so forth, you will see how that, in subtle ways, is always present in his thinking and in his actions. So what's he done? First of all, in his encyclicals, so for instance, with Laudato Si, the popes until Paul VI had always farmed out their encyclicals to theologians to at least give the draft. Then the Pope would go over it and do his own editing and say what he wanted to say, but the encyclicals were farmed out. That sort of, from Paul VI through John Paul II and Benedict XVI, that became, the popes were more and more writing their own encyclicals. Francis has done that, but with Laudato Si, he called together scientists, lay people, Catholic and non-Catholic. They worked hard on getting that encyclical out and getting it right. So that's one way he's brought in the laity. Then, the Synod of Bishops. The Synod of Bishops originated in 1965 through the intervention of Pope St. Paul VI, how to deal with this issue of collegiality, episcopal collegiality. So the Pope intervened with the, what he called the Synod of Bishops. It's really not, has nothing to do really with collegiality, because in this document, the Synod becomes a consulting body for the Holy See. It has no authority of itself. It's a consulting body. That redefines what a synod is, because a synod was the same thing as a council, and councils are decision-making bodies. They can make decisions binding on the church. The Synod of Bishops, as such, cannot do that. It can do that only insofar as it's ratified by the Pope and taken as really as his word. So these synods under John Paul II and Benedict were often seemed to be, bishops complained, they were not much more than rubber stamps. The decisions were made before they got there. Not entirely true, but by and large, that's the case. And by and large, it was exclusively a clerical affair. Francis has done two things. One, he gets the bishops there, says, we want to know what you think. And he's given them freedom to express different views. This has led to some confusion, but it's also gotten stuff out on the table. It's a big change. Secondly, he's had lay people present and intervening. This was especially true in the Synod on the Amazon, the Synod on, but at any rate. So lay participation in these synods, and he's, although not quite teaching, treating them as full decision-making bodies, in effect, he's doing that by trying to synthesize what the result of this conversation, of the conversation was. So it's a significant change. Then thirdly, he's been insisting on the revival of local synods. And last year, well, actually it was 2018, in March of 2018, the International Theological Commission issued an important document called Synodality in the Church, the role of synods in the church. Its basic point is that synods are the way to go for the church in the 21st century. Local synods and national synods. In that document, it's a long document, very carefully thought out, they worked on it for about 5 or 6 years, the role of the laity is predominant. One statement in it is that the laity has a role on every level of church governance. So these synods, if they catch on, will really introduce the laity back into their role that they had all the way through history, now on a different level. The practical question is which laity, how they selected, and so on and so forth. So that's a big problem. But the principle is there, and that's what's important. So the lay voice participating in these local synods, a diocesan synod, and why wouldn't these synods have something to say about the choice of their chief shepherd, of the bishop of the diocese? So it's a way to conceivably reintroduce the laity into this process Episcopal nominations to get a lay voice there. So that's, I think we're really, you know, you can't predict the future. This might all just die and dead and be forgotten. But if it proceeds, we're at a new stage now, and I think a very exciting stage. And this is due to Pope Francis. So thank you. Now for some nice comments, objections, and questions and answers. Thank you.
There'll be time for questions. A couple of things I should mention. This is being recorded. Tony Tambasco next week will do follow-up on today's talk. And third, we have members of our parish council here, and one of whom will be chosen to be on the diocesan council looking at these issues. So could the parish council representatives please stand, just so afterwards people know they can speak with you as their representatives to move this ball forward. So let's go to questions. Judith, do we have for people to ask questions so they can be heard? Okay. Do you have your mic back? Okay. So let me move around so that people can ask.
Well, what about me?
I'll bring you back. Okay, Trish.
So not just questions, comments, and so forth are very welcome. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Father. I'm Daisy Schaefer. I went to school in France for part of my high school. And both in the US and in France, a great deal was made of Gallicanism, how the kings infuriated a succession of popes by presuming to name bishops, which would suggest that the role of the rulers, of the secular rulers in naming bishops, was probably a little bit earlier and a bit more contested than your sort of diagram of your talk would suggest. But what I'm really interested in is...
Well, let's deal with that.
Okay.
Good question.
Yes, indeed. There were a lot of problems. And when you read any church history, it's the problems that get the attention, get the space in the books. In fact, for the most part, this worked reasonably well. And the Holy See agreed with the nominations of bishops. We need to kind of rethink what we're talking about. In Gallicanism, that's got a really bad name. But you have to see, when you look at the whole context, what it's really trying to say was the local church has a role that should not be usurped by the Holy See. That there's a balance there between the two. Now we've got your second part, part two of her. Yeah.
Thank you. But how do you get beyond the laity that are kings, queens, princes, etc., and those of us who are more banana-eating public, arguably educated, a lot of theologians, but people with a very strong interest both in how the church governs itself and in abuses that have taken place?
That's the problem. So, as with Vatican I, the problem is, okay, which laity, how chosen? How to avoid the being chosen by a interested group that is a self-interested group and was powerful, maybe wealthy, and so forth. So that's the problem. Well, now I think Kevin suggested that this diocesan synod is going to be a representative of the church, your church council is going to go. So this is the issue to be worked out. It was simpler in the olden times because who were the laity? who were the clergy, really. They were the upper, they were the higher class of society, and so they were the rulers. But today it's very much more complicated. That's been a problem since the French Revolution. So, study your French Revolution.
Hi, John. I'm Peter Albert.
I know you, Peter.
Following up on that question, it seems to me that there's simultaneously with the top-down reintroduction of laity and the synods, there's a sort of a bottom-up. It's a blunt tool, but it seems to me that there's a withholding of contributions to the local church and a creation of a financial stringency at the parish level and the diocesan level, where the laity is insistent on some sort of voice, and for lack of another voice, they're voting with their pocketbooks.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's not true of every parish around the world, I can tell you that. But you're absolutely right. So this is, I mean, the Catholic Church is a huge, complex organization, a lot of things going on at the same time. That's certainly one. So this role of the laity, the role that you people have here in Holy Trinity, I mean, that's an extremely important, vibrant part of the role of the laity in the church. So am I agreeing with you, or am I going beyond you, or what? Okay, good. That's always good to know. He's a former student of mine.
Father, there are certain lay people in the United States, it seems like they're all out in California, they have a thing called the Knapp Institute. They hate Francis. They like to see him get the hell out of there, you know? And also, there are a couple of cardinals in Rome, one out of St. Louis, okay? I think they want to get rid of him also. My question is, how powerful are those people? And in your opinion, is Francis dealing with them correctly?
Well, I mean, I talk to Pope Francis just about every day, you know. Even so, I'm a little confused about how he handles them. He's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, because if he, with Cardinal Burke, if he removes Cardinal Burke, I mean, that just creates more problems. So I think he just has to kind of grit his teeth and take it. How people can be against a pope and be Catholic is beyond me. I can see how. I mean, I was not a great fan of Pope John Paul II or a great fan of Pope Benedict, but I certainly was not anti them. I certainly respected them and followed their teaching as best I could in whatever the field was. So, but to be like people who are against Vatican II. You're against an ecumenical council, not only an ecumenical council, it's the biggest council in the history of the church, ratified by two saints. I mean, come on. Anyway, back to the present situation. It's really difficult. One straw I grasp at is the nomination of cardinals by Pope Francis that will, I'd like to think, ensure a succession that is along his line. And again, you have to take the long view, and it's a big church, and the American church is Pope Francis's big problem. It's not a world, I mean, it's anti-Francis is here and there. It's certainly in Italy, backed by a lot by American money, but it's rampant in the United States. The French college in Rome, too, for other points, there are pockets of it. But it's not a church-wide issue.
Yes.
Where you are.
This is, you know, this works, too. So.
Robert Joseph, to what extent did the Vatican II introduce the idea of the archdiocesan pastoral councils and parish pastoral councils? Does that come out of a Vatican II, or does that come out of some later pronouncement?
Well, Vatican II sort of reintroduced the idea. I mean, once it was able to ratify the idea of episcopal collegiality, that is to say, the collegial relationship between the bishops and the Pope, the papacy, then it went down to other levels, and sort of talked about this being a phenomenon down the line. But after the council, I mean, Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict were not enthusiastic about that at all, and really sort of just didn't promote it. But Pope Francis is picking it up again. Does that answer you?
I would just say that I had the privilege of living in Chicago and being on the Archdiocesan Pastoral Council for Cardinal Bernardin, who took it very seriously.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I guess I was later surprised to find out, well, not anybody did. And I was always interested to see the traction within which pastoral councils at the parish level took root was, it really did depend at the lowest level what the pastor wanted, and I understand that. But that's an interesting development to me, and you're actually shedding some insight that is from a lot of attitudes from the top would influence these institutions.
Absolutely. I mean, just as you know, Cardinal Bernardin, in many of his initiatives, the Common Ground Initiative and so forth, was not supported by the other American cardinals.
Good morning. Thanks, John, for a wonderful romp, as you said, through history. I'm wondering, it's not the topic for today, but if we're going to have a renewal of the role of the laity, and hopefully, and so forth, does there have to be some companion rethinking of the theology of ministry, of priesthood, and so forth as a companion in order to make it work well or something? Because it seems to me we do have this clerical model, and I'm wondering, your thoughts, do we have to have a rethinking of some of the nature of the priesthood, the history of it, and ministry, and so forth, to flesh it out?
Yeah. That rethinking has been going on, especially the last 50 years, so there's an immense amount of literature on it, which I just dip into occasionally and so forth. I don't follow it all that closely. But you must remember, so what does it mean to be a cleric? It means to be trained for your profession. And so that's how it developed, that you have this group set aside because they studied the scripture and so forth, and had the respect of their communities and therefore had this special role. So it needs it. It is being rethought. So I'd say stay tuned.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd like to go back to the issue of national synods, and I've read about what they're trying to do in Germany. But it seems there's been some pushback against that from the Vatican and I think from the Pope himself. So if you have any thoughts about that or can shed any light on it, I'd appreciate it.
I have to be honest, I don't. I know that this has been going on. I really haven't followed that. I just don't know. But obviously, first of all, controversy and disagreement is the human way. I mean, we all have our own opinions, and so what we need to do is to get those issues out on the table and address them serenely and objectively as we can. That's the ideal. So when we talked there about the role of the secular authorities in the appointment of bishops, there were big conflicts. So that's to be expected. Each case has to be sort of decided on its own merits. Did I weasel out of that pretty well?
John, good question. My name's Gil Devine. I see a lot of Gen X and Gen Zs who've been raised in the Catholic Church. When they go off from their families, don't attend the Catholic Church. They look around their neighborhood and find churches that really appeal to them. Is there anything that the Pope is doing to try to attract young people back to the Church?
I don't know. I mean, that is a huge, huge problem, and especially in the USA. So I just have a letter from a person
yesterday talking about her parish up in Minnesota, Minnesota. Very discouraging. I don't know what Francis is doing, except the example of his own ministry. I really feel that, you know, so many things with Pope Francis, they say, yes, well, these are his pastoral gestures. Like when he brought those Muslims back to live in the Vatican and set them in the beginning of his pontificate. Is that just a pastoral gesture? Is he not proclaiming to the world one of the basic tenets of Christianity? I was a stranger and you took me in. Is that just pastoral? Seems to me that's very doctrinal. Maybe not in the creed, but it should be. What do we believe? We believe in the corporal works of mercy, right? So that's my brief sermon for today.
Around that, I'd like to make an observation that we have young men and women here today from our youth group. Later we have our young adults gathering, but you're the future, and we're glad you're here representing your generation, because you are the future of the church. So it's a symbolic gesture, but it's also a statement. I'd also, any member of the parish council, like to respond to anything John's saying, because this is the kind of stuff we talk about, of how do we move the parish forward with lay decision making. So does anyone, Chris or Jim, or have to put you on the spot?
No, not at all.
You want to say anything? Chris is the chair of the parish council.
Easy question, okay.
Very well, thank you. Thank you, Father. I appreciate it. I would say here at Holy Trinity, we do try to live out the model of lay leadership that you were articulating, Father. Our parish council doesn't make decisions, right? They don't direct the staff. They don't direct finances. They don't direct the pastor. We do have a lay finance council on which our parish council vice president, Jim Thessen, sits, among other lay leaders in the parish. So we are primarily a consultative body, but we are one with that provides oversight and guidance to a lot of the standing committees, in which I know a number of the people in this room sit, and one that helps direct a lot of the parishioner-led ministries we have here at Holy Trinity, and one that is going to have a voice, a direct voice, at the archdiocesan level with one of our colleagues who will soon be an advisor to Archbishop Wilton Gregory. So, it's a consultative model of lay leadership at Holy Trinity, but it's one that I think serves us well and can be a model to other parishes in the archdiocese. I'd invite any of my other colleagues to jump in.
I agree. I think that Holy Trinity is a wonderful model.
Tony,
Father O'Malley, after Vatican II, if I remember correctly, there was a group called Call to Action, which was made up of laity and was supported by Cardinal Duren, who was then the president of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Seems to me that worked for a couple of years, and then they lost the support of leadership in the church. What's the story there? What's the lesson there? Or do you know?
Well, I think the lesson is don't give up. You're absolutely right. I mean, as a matter of fact, the first big call to action meeting in Detroit, I was there. I spoke at it. So I know it very well. And I knew Cardinal Dearden. I wasn't as great friend of his, but I knew him and respected him very much. But then the leadership changed. And we're now have a new style of leadership, which is, so Pope Francis, I mean, he's getting opposition. It's a change from the past, 35 years or so.
Related to that, last week we learned that Richard Call, who is a parishioner, former member of the parish council, is now the director of social justice at the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops. So one of our own is at the table. Tony, could you say something about next week's follow-up and how you intend to move?
What I will probably do, one of the things I'll say is that my pen ran out at the very first sentence of the notes I was taking today. So
for heaven's sakes, Tony.
But
and you were a teacher.
Probably I will try to give a resume next week because there'll be some people here who will not have come today. But I think the main thing that I want to do next week is draw out of the people who have been here and then maybe the people who come next week some suggestions on things that we might be able to do as a parish to keep kind of pushing some of these issues. I might have my own comments on some of the things that you say and where I think some of the problems are, you know, and people have already begun, I think, to kind of raise a lot of the issues that look like they're intractable. So trying to see how we can address some of those things might be of interest. I don't pretend that next week we're going to solve all the problems, but I think it's just to kind of keep things going with interest and, you know, some kind of activity. So.
And I recommend this Wednesday night we have our parish council meeting, so this will bubble up to that meeting too this weekend. Time for one last question, is that right? We got two. All right. One, two.
I just wanted to respond to this gentleman over here about call to action. I was the executive director for Cardinal Dearden for the call to action. So there's a great new book on this coming out later this year called Belonging. And look for it in your bookstore.
Are you the author?
I am.
Yeah. How did I ever guess?
Father, I wanted to also raise another question, which I think is really important, and that is the point that Cardinal John Henry Newman raised in the Sensus Fidelium. How important that is in the church. I think if you just comment briefly to tell the audience what that is all about, because it does pertain to consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine. Our belief, our practice, how that plays a role in the church. It's not the governance question, which we focused on here, and the power sharing. It's what where doctrine resides. I think it's very important for us to understand the dignity of our role in the church.
Well, you're singing the same song as Pope Francis. That's exactly what he's saying, to consult the faithful, to let them be one of your markers as to what the teaching of the church is, what the practice of the church is and should be. So, and Newman, the Second Vatican Council, that was brought up a number of times. As a matter of fact, it's in the document on Revelation, the voice of the faithful, that their faith is the what you really believe, that has to rise up to the top level. So I mean, even for instance, with Pius the Ninth on the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, you consult the bishops to consult their faithful. What they believed in that regard.
Hi, I wanted to make a comment about young people in the church. When I was in high school in Pennsylvania, I was invited to a youth synod in Harrisburg, and I felt so important and so listened to. And that actually encouraged me to continue to be active in the church in college, which is when a lot of people, you know, there's no time, lots of other things going on. I don't know if there still are youth synods, but I thought it was a great idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, the synodal church, that's the way Francis is talking about it. So a church of synods. So there are all kinds of different kinds of synods you can have. And youth synods sounds like a good one.
Yeah, I resonate with that because when I was in college, this is exactly what happened in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. From ninth grade to seniors in college, we scan the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, asserting their needs, and we had a voice. And that gave us lay people a sense we could change church. They're still trying to change Philadelphia, but that's another story. Well, with that note, John, thank you very much. This has been